Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with Robert Reich, professor at UC Berkeley and former Secretary of Labor, about his latest book, The System: Who Rigged It, How to Fix It. And we'll also talk about the coronavirus pandemic, a public health, financial, social, and political crisis. And you can learn more about Robert's work at robertreich.org. That's Robert, R-E-I-C-H, one word, robertreich.org. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land, The Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net. A quick plug for participation, there's not much participating we can do right now. Just look and see what you can do in your community to help those who are most hurting in response to the virus and the shutdown. Now to today's conversation. This is a tough interview with what's going on in the world, not least because events are changing every few hours. Before the pandemic, I believe Robert Reich and I would both have made the point that merely getting rid of Donald Trump would not fix what ails the US. Trump is a symptom, not a cause. Same is true of getting through this pandemic, as monumental as that will be. The U.S. has been ailing for years. Unhealthy and consistently growing inequality of wealth, opportunity, and power has weakened democracy and fractured society. With regard to the virus, a few countries seem to have taken strong action soon enough and completely enough to hold the worst of the crisis to a few months. We can assume that even with the best leadership, there would have been a lockdown in the U.S., and the economic and social disruption that entails, in addition to the pain the virus itself inflicts. The question would have been, for how long? We're going to talk about Professor Reich's new book, which confronts the system that paved the way for Donald Trump. But first, we've got to talk about the pandemic and America and Trump's responses to it. So let me share a few of my fairly random thoughts. Leaving aside, for the most part, the political and health events unfolding, there's plenty of good information out there on those fronts. This lockdown will be an experiment. We are social beings. There's already a crisis of loneliness. We're already worried about losing ourselves on screens. Without jobs or sports or arts or church, where are individuals going to find meaning? If you wanted to mutate society away from human physical contact toward mediated online personas, you could do worse than capitalize on the disruption of social distancing. When everything is scarce, money, freedom, healthcare, how are people going to react? When you begin to envision a roller coaster of flattening the curve that could last 18 months, perhaps until we have a vaccine, I worry about things like domestic abuse and child abuse. Partners and families will be constricted and hidden. Nobody at work to notice or at church. Nobody looking in on them. No social workers checking up on families with a history. I often recommend Rebecca Solnit's book, Paradise in a Place Called Hell, which reminds us that confronting natural disasters brings out our best. So why do I find myself fearing the worst? Probably because we've seen the worst happen too often lately. Trump's election, our treatment of refugees, wildfires, hurricanes, the way impeachment played out, Russian interference in our elections. I assume it's becoming clear to just about everyone that in the face of this crisis, we need government. We need government to work. And the usual narrative would be that people are going to realize that we're all in this together. And if government could do a great job of dealing with the pandemic, that might shift public perception, begin to reverse decades of right-wing attacks, and allow for a stronger safety net and a more fair and just society moving forward. Beyond survival, our goal should be to seize this moment, to turn shock doctrine and disaster capitalism on its head. By government performing well in this crisis while people are in real need, We could change public attitudes. But Trump. The federal government is not going to seize this moment. But perhaps we can learn from the best governors, and the contrast with Trump could help make the case. Finally, no matter what anyone says, the people of America did not elect Donald Trump. The Electoral College did. And in my gut, it's just not right. I understand these are the current rules, but any leader with this much responsibility in this scale of a crisis should have to be elected by the people. So we will talk about the coronavirus and our response, and we will talk about the system. Before the pandemic, before Trump, millions of Americans had lost confidence in our political and economic system. Stagnant wages, volatile job markets, and unwillingness by those in power to deal with threats like climate change had fed a sense that the system is fixed and serves only those with enough money to buy power. In the last debate of 2016, Trump repeatedly made the point that Hillary had been part of the DC power structure for 30 years and nothing had changed. Things had only gotten worse. Don't let Trump's madness distract you. Robert Reich makes clear the battle is no longer between left and right, but between democracy and oligarchy. Robert Reich, Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, served as Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He's a founding editor of American Prospect magazine, writes a weekly column for The Guardian and Newsweek, and is co-creator of the award-winning documentaries Inequality for All and Saving Capitalism. Reich has written 18 books, including The Work of Nations, Supercapitalism, Common Good, Locked in the Cabinet, and his latest, The System, Who Rigged It, How to Fix It. Welcome again, Robert Reich, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Well, thank you, Terrence.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, March 24th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. So let me start off with two questions. One, how and why did you originally get involved in government? And then how would you describe your evolution to your current work, which includes frequent articles and messages where you've become sort of an online presence, a progressive conscience for people in their social media?
Well, Terrence, I got involved in government in the 1960s. It was a very idealistic time, as you may recall, or you certainly have heard about.
I was there.
And the civil rights movement was something that was a living, breathing, powerful influence on me, as was then the anti-Vietnam War movement. In 1968, I became an intern in the office of Robert Kennedy, his Senate office. And I think that was the time when my eyes were opened widest upon, you know, what could be done. It was, Robert Kennedy was one of my idols. I thought that he really had begun to understand what was going on in the country, what needed to happen in the country. He was in the process of creating a very important coalition of people of color and working class people and progressives. And I got excited about the possibilities of what government could do. And this was, remember, this was 1968. It was a terrible year, it turned out, because he was then subsequently, obviously, assassinated. I had worked for Eugene McCarthy in the 1968 campaign, presidential campaign. And when the assassination occurred and McCarthy did not get the Democratic nomination, Hubert Humphrey got the nomination, and then subsequently Richard Nixon was elected president, I thought the world had basically fallen in on itself. Injustice reigned. The worst kind of aspects of America seemed to be coming to the fore. That was a pivotal year for the country. It was certainly, in terms of my own experience, a pivotal year for me. I then came back and worked in the Carter administration, in the Federal Trade Commission, which had a lot to do with mergers and acquisitions and fair trade. What I saw in the late 70s was a very different Washington from the Washington I had seen in the 60s. By the late 70s, big corporations had begun to wield a lot of power and put a lot of money into presidential campaigns and the campaigns of senators and members of Congress, and they set up trade associations in Washington. Washington began to be engulfed in money. Now, I didn't even know how bad it was going to get. My third round in Washington was in the Clinton administration, where I was Secretary of Labor. By the mid-1990s, Washington was completely inundated with corporate money, with Wall Street money. Labor unions had shrunken dramatically. Even though I was Secretary of Labor, it was very difficult to push anything that labor wanted because labor's own political power had declined so dramatically. There was no countervailing power in Washington. It was almost all big corporations, wealthy individuals, and Wall Street. But even then, I didn't know how bad it was going to get. I guess the last real time I had in Washington was briefly advising then President-elect Obama on what he should do with regard to the implosion, the 2008 financial crisis. And he was being advised by some people who said, well, you needed to have a big, big bailout for Wall Street. Some others of us were saying, well, what about people? What about how people who are going to lose their homes or who would not have income or they might lose their savings? Shouldn't they come first? And I remember having debates in the early part of 2008. I'm sorry, it must have been the latter part of 2008, before he became president. It was just a latter 2008, 2009, about whether Wall Street came first or people came first and how to make sure that the bailouts of Wall Street were not just going to suck up all of the available taxpayer money. Well, now, fast forward, here we are in 2020. You know, I am 50 years older than I was when I went to Robert F. Kennedy's Senate office, and the tables have been turned completely. Instead of a movement that Robert F. Kennedy represented, creating a coalition of people of color and working class and progressives making their way toward greater and greater power and effect in Washington and around the country, we now have corporations and Wall Street and the wealthy who have never had, since the Gilded Age of the 1880s or 1890s, as much power and influence, in the middle even of a pandemic, where you would expect those with power and influence to maybe be a little bit self-conscious about wielding their power and influence so obviously. And I get to this in my book, although I didn't foresee the pandemic, but what I had to say is sadly, grimly, even more relevant today. And yet what we see is the most blatant exercises of privilege and power to favor themselves, getting bailouts, getting privileged positions with regard to federal money, getting tests and other things that other people cannot get, and also now trying to, and it looks like they are succeeding, in getting people back to work when people ought to be staying home because of the coronavirus. I suppose I can't really express to you adequately to the degree to which, Terrence, I feel that over the last 50 years, I've seen the fundamental corrosion of the system of the United States from a democracy into an oligarchy that is very dangerous.
Yeah, no, I'm so with you on that. And it was interesting. I hadn't realized you had started that far back with Robert Kennedy. We've one thing that I always say when we look at the rightward turn of this nation, or certainly of the Washington and the Beltway, is you can't discount the power of assassination. Having lost two Kennedys, Martin Luther King, you don't get leaders like that every day. And to have the nation and the progressive people's side robbed of that leadership is inestimable.
Well, it's really I think irony is not the right word. It goes beyond irony. To lose Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, who could have been and would have been the leaders of the next 50 years, or certainly set the nation on the right track for the next 50 years, and then 50 years hence, to have the nation run by Donald Trump, the least, I mean, if you lined up everybody in America, I think he would be probably on the least appropriate temperamentally or psychologically or in terms of intelligence end of the continuum for being president of the United States, even in good times. And obviously, these are very, very dangerous times, and we are we are dealing with a president who's not just out of his depth and doesn't know he's out of his depth, but a president who really has no sense of what the public needs. And spends so much of his time and attention and so much of his consciousness trying to boost his own ego and his own prominence and his own narcissistic goals, rather than have any conception of what is going on now for ordinary people, that I just shudder for the future of this country.
Yeah, I am absolutely with you. And that's to go back just again to that second question that I had asked you. Your evolution, as I've seen you over the years, from a professor who works in government, advises government, writes books, to someone who is an online presence delivering the progressive message in all sorts of styles. How did that happen? I mean, even to become the documentary filmmaker. How did that happen, and where do you see yourself right now?
Some people who know me have said that I've moved to the left quite dramatically over the last five decades. I don't think so. I think that when I was working for Robert F. Kennedy, my values were very similar to what they are right now. I think the country, unfortunately, has moved to the right. I've just stayed put. In terms of media, and I think you're asking, and communications, I still write books. The new book that's just coming out, or just came out, on called The System, I spend a huge amount of time on it. I think it's important to provide the public with in-depth analysis and frameworks for understanding what's going on. One of my sons, Sam Reich, who is in a kind of media video world, he runs collegehumor.com. He said to me, I don't know, it must have been about 9 or 10 years ago, "Dad, you've got to get involved in social media," because although he said to me, he appreciated my books, he said that people, if they don't really reach people, I needed to explore videos and documentaries and the possibilities of reaching people to educate them about what was going on other media, on social media, on other communications vehicles. Well, I didn't really know what he was talking about, and I was kind of depressed, frankly. Because I still wanted to write books, and I still thought that book writing was important. I still believe it is, but he opened my eyes to the world of social media that was just in its infancy then. And I did begin with Facebook and Twitter, and then Instagram. although these platforms have terrible problems and are very, very dangerous when misused, as we've seen in the 2016 election, and we've seen before and after under Trump, they are and can be, I have found, very useful ways of getting ideas and facts and analyses and kind of frameworks across to people. And so I've been devoting a considerable time to that. I co-founded a small group called Inequality Media, a little team. I mean, we're just five people, but we're putting out about two or three videos a week, a lot of material on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and also YouTube, and reaching millions of people in ways that I never thought possible. And I would like to think that we are helping keep the progressive flame alive. Although, Terrence, one thing that I wanted to clarify, and it's an important point that you made and I make in my book, rather than think about this as left versus right or progressive versus conservative, I think it's more important today to see the real divide in this country between democracy and oligarchy. Many people who call themselves conservatives or Tea Partiers or even some Trump supporters, I find when talking to them, not at the level of slogans or labels, but really underneath all of that, they share a lot of views about the system. They feel disempowered. They feel that, and they know that the game is rigged in favor of the people at the top. They understand intuitively that the oligarchy, and I'm going to use the term oligarchy, it's a good old Greek term meaning wealth and power in the hands of a very few people. They understand that the oligarchy has a stake in keeping all of us separate and angry with each other so that we don't look upward and see where all the wealth and power has gone. And one of the goals that I have had in writing the book and also in a lot of the social media work that I've done is to help people across the political spectrum understand this fundamental fact. Whether we call ourselves on the left or the right, conservatives or liberals or progressives, we have much more in common with each other than we do with the oligarchy that is trying to, that is really running off with the wealth and the power of the country. And in times like this of national emergency, of the coronavirus, it is possible to see the contours of power more readily and more visibly than we can almost any time that is ostensibly normal.
Yeah, I got it. So thank you very much. Now, if we let me ask a couple more questions about the current situation. If we're likely to remain in lockdown for an extended period of time, and as we saw yesterday, that was the 23rd of March, President Trump is chafing to end that lockdown as much power as he has on the federal level, since the real lockdowns are happening by wise governors in troubled states. But if we were to remain in lockdown, how do you think we could best use the levers of government to cushion the economic and social damage, both nationally and to families?
Well, we shouldn't pay one dime of bailout money to big corporations, airlines, cruise ships, hotels. That's a terrible, it's not just a waste of taxpayer money, but every dollar, every dime ought to be going to families and individuals instead, real people. And that money should be used for income maintenance for people to stay home. The goal here is not to get the economy going. The economy has got to shut down. The goal is to stop or at least reduce the incidence and the speed of the spread of this pandemic. And the way to do that is to have people home, to shut down the economy except for absolutely essential services. Now, this is something that Trump began to understand about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, some of his public health advisors, Anthony Fauci, for example, began to get through to him. But now the Wall Street crowd and big corporations are starting to get back through to him. They've already, well, they already had the most influence. It was kind of an amazing that Trump began to listen to the concerns of public health, began to see that there were severe, high probabilities of millions of people dying in the United States because of this pandemic. And he just started to give people like Anthony Fauci a little bit of airtime. But he's now falling back to type. He's listening to the Wall Streeters. I don't know if you saw it, but Blankfein, Lloyd Blankfein, who is the senior chairman of Goldman Sachs, he tweeted just yesterday, that would have been March 23rd, he tweeted that we ought to be getting people back to work as fast as possible in the next couple of weeks. Well, that to me was kind of a signal, because Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, obviously is from Goldman Sachs, and the Wall Streeters, you know, they can work from home. They don't have to worry about lockdowns. They want to get the economy back. They want people back at work, even if it means that the spread of the virus is going to intensify. They think that the economy is more important than public health, because they are the big winners when it comes to the economy. They're the big losers right now because the stock market has lost 30% of its value. So it's not surprising that they are placing higher priority on the economy than on the pandemic and on keeping people home and safe. And it's not surprising that Trump is beginning to listen to all of these people. But it is vitally important that the rest of us continue to signal to our representatives in Washington, our senators and our representatives, if you can't get through to them, just leave a message that we want the economy locked down so that people can be safe. And we want people to get income support while they are locked down. And that is the highest priority. We also want them to have health care support so that if the emergency happens and they actually do need to get to the hospital, they can afford it. We want to make sure that hospitals get the supplies of ventilators and ICUs and masks they need so that the hospitals can be prepared and hospital workers don't get infected. These are the priorities, not bailing out big companies.
Just a couple of quick notes, Robert. One is that it seems that there was a specific study out of the Imperial College of London which projected that if America did not lock down, it might lose from 500,000 to 2.2 million people to death, that I think contributed to waking him up in addition to trusting for a few days Anthony Fauci. And on the other side, you may have seen this, but there was a Fox News late night Sunday night, a Fox News host who said, the cure can't be worse than the problem. We should reassess in 15 days. And sure enough, within minutes, Trump sent out an all caps tweet with exactly that language. So it's a combination of listening to Lloyd Blankfein and listening to Fox News that I think moves this president.
Let me get back to that, because I think it's important. That London study was critically important for opening the way for Trump to listen to Fauci. But Trump doesn't listen to studies. He doesn't read studies. He doesn't respond to science. What actually happened was that a couple of people around him, Jared Kushner, and Ivanka Trump did listen to those studies, and they convinced him to begin to place a higher priority on public health. And then what happened Yes, Fox News was incredibly significant, and Fox News is the bearer of messages to Trump. But Fox News did not do it on its own. Fox News is the not just state-run media, but it is the voice for Wall Street and for big corporations in the United States. It is the voice of the American oligarchy. And so when Wall Street and big corporations last weekend began to say, no, the cure is worse than the disease. We can't actually shut down the economy. We need to get the economy rolling again, even if a lot of people are going to be sacrificial victims. That's when Fox News picked up the theme and conveyed the theme to Trump. Even at the same time that the Goldman Sachs people were telling the same thing to Mnuchin. Trump is... It really only listens to Fox News and to Wall Street via Mnuchin. That's it.
Yeah. So let me just tell people, by the way, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor, about his latest book, The System, Who Rigged It, How to Fix It. And we're talking about the coronavirus pandemic, a public health, financial, social, and political crisis, and talking about the system that was the context in which this pandemic hit America's shores. You can learn more at robertreich.org. That's one word, Robert Reich, and Reich is R-E-I-C-H. Okay, the last question I think on the current crisis is, on March 16th, you wrote an article titled, America Doesn't Have a Public Health System. And you contrast it with America's financial system, again, as a context in which this crisis is happening. Would you like to expand on that just a bit?
Yes, it's interesting and revealing that the only systemic oversight we have of any aspect of this economy or society is finance. A lousy job in the years leading up to the 2008 financial crisis. But it is true that the Federal Reserve Board, does require banks, for example, to maintain reserves, extra capacity in case of national emergencies. And the Fed keeps a very careful eye on what the banks have and what the banks need. When it comes to public health, we don't have anything like that. We have instead a system of corporate-run, for-profit healthcare corporations, and they don't have any extra capacity. Our hospitals actually are run on minimal capacity because that's the best way of making money. You don't want to have any excess capacity because that's costly. And there is no oversight in terms of a public health authority analogous to the Fed with regard to the financial institutions that would be instructing hospitals as to what kinds of equipment and what kinds of capacity they need in order to maintain kind of an adequate system in response to possible dangers. There's nothing. Other countries do have public health systems. We used to have the beginnings of a public health system, but basically our entire healthcare system has been taken over by for-profit corporations, just as and simultaneously our system of public safety nets, which started to grow in the 1960s with Medicare and Medicaid, and kind of building on Franklin D. Roosevelt's systems of the 1930s, all of those systems of social safety nets began unraveling after Ronald Reagan was in the White House in the 80s. I was in Washington in the 1990s, and I saw and witnessed, sadly, Bill Clinton decide to get rid of welfare, AFDC, and substitute something that was totally inadequate called temporary aid to needy families, a five-year maximum public assistance for life for people. What we've ended up with is a system that is a non-system. We have no real social safety net for people. We can see it now. This kind of public health crisis reveals, as it reveals the system of power, it also reveals how vulnerable average Americans are without sick leave, without adequate income support through unemployment insurance, without medical help, without any kind of access to doctors or healthcare professionals that is affordable to most people. We alone among rich nations simply do not have either a public health system or a system of social supports. And it's coming back to haunt us right now.
Absolutely. One thing I will point out that where you were talking about that our private healthcare system believes that capacity should be as low as possible so as not to waste money on things they might not need today. Trump voiced that same approach when he was asked about the disbanding of the pandemic preparedness group within the National Security Council and a lot of the experts that had been on the government payroll. He said, well, I don't want people around that we're not using. I can grab them when I need them. So that kind of thinking just runs right through this.
Well, Frank, if I can make an additional point on that. Trump refuses to use the Defense Production Act to require companies that could produce ventilators and ICUs and masks and other equipment to do so. He says he doesn't want to interfere in the free market. Well, by the same token, Trump and Republicans are trying to get this big bailout bill, which would interfere in the free market to the degree of $500 billion, bailing out the airlines, the cruise ships, the hotels, which not incidentally, Donald Trump has a great interest in. So there is no principle at stake here. The free market is a free market that cannot be interfered with when it comes to constraining in any way what profit-seeking companies want to do. But the free market the government can interfere in the free market when it comes to bailing out companies that ostensibly need it but don't really need it because they always have Chapter 11 bankruptcy because they're big companies and they have a lot of assets. So this is revealing again for everybody to see what the actual structure of power and influence is in this country.
And that brings us to the book. But let me throw in one comment. One thing that I have noticed is that China, with missteps at first, authoritarian missteps, but then a concerted national effort that seems to have kept the kept the pandemic to sort of an ideal outcome so far. Russia, interestingly, we hear very little about Russia, but it appears, if their numbers are correct, they also went at this in a very strong reaction, a lot of testing, and they seem to have come out so far well. It strikes me that while Trump fancies himself a strong man, envies these authoritarians in style, in ego gratification, in power, but unlike them, he hates the federal government. And so he abuses the power for his own gratification, but won't use the power to help the people.
Well, let me take a slightly different tack on this. I think Donald Trump condemns the federal government every chance he gets. He calls it a deep state. But when he wants to use the levers of government for his own ends, like putting up a wall along the southern border, even though Congress explicitly did not give him that authority or that money, he will just take it. He will act like a dictator when it suits his purposes, but he will not act like a dictator when it doesn't suit his purposes, such as using the Defense Production Act to require companies to help Americans and help hospitals get what they need. With regard to authoritarian regimes, I think a better example for the United States than Russia or China would be South Korea. South Korea is a democracy. It's a well-functioning democracy, not perfect. There's no perfect functioning democracy. But South Korea did manage to do what China did, but earlier than China. And South Korea, it looks like, has actually avoided the kind of problems with regard to the coronavirus spreading rapidly and overwhelming its hospitals. China, South Korea has avoided that in ways that any democracy that has a well-run system and a responsible civil service and a good and responsible and responsive president ought to be able to do. So it doesn't take an authoritarian. It just takes a well-working and responsive democracy.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Okay, so let's turn to the book. How did this book, The System, happen? What did you set out to do? What did you hope to accomplish?
Basically, as I indicated, you know, earlier in the program, I've seen over the last 50 years of my own career in and out of government, I've seen a major change in wealth and power. In the 1960s, America, we still had a very large middle class. We still had a lot of work to do. We did pass the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and we have made progress with regard to opportunities for women and for Latinos, not as much as we should, but certainly we have. We did in the 1960s at least achieve the beginnings of a more equitable society. And by equitable society, I mean not equal society, but equal opportunity and equal political rights. But then what I witnessed in and out of government was a sea change starting around the time of Ronald Reagan, when wages for almost everybody flattened. Adjusted for inflation, the median wage today, that is the wage of the person smack in the middle and everybody below him or her, is no longer growing. In fact, it stopped growing in the late 1970s, early 1980s. The typical worker today, adjusted for inflation, is earning no more than he or she did in the 1978. The economy is almost three times as large. Where did all the money go? Where did all the economic gains go? Well, a lot of them went to the top. We now have a second Gilded Age. We now have a huge amount of wealth and power. And power goes with wealth. Wealth goes with power. And that's another point I witnessed when I was in government, when I was Secretary of Labor. I saw what wealth and power were doing. I saw it up close. I made a lot of notes to myself just because I said to myself, look, if this continues much longer, we're going to lose our democracy. We're going to become an oligarchy. We are going to actually find ourselves suddenly waking up one day with most people having no real practical effect or voice at all. And the only voice being the voice of big corporations, CEOs, very wealthy people, Wall Street. Well, it has come to pass. And what I wanted to do in a book that I wanted to make a short book, because people just don't have the time to read a long book. I wanted to make a kind of in distilled version of what I've learned about how the economy and politics actually work. Not what we read in textbooks, not what we hear on CNN when we hear academic economists and others and political scientists talk about what the way the system is supposed to be running or in their view does run. No, I wanted to talk about what is actually occurring, how it actually works or doesn't work, why the economy is generating huge wealth at the top, but basically nothing for most people, why our political system is so skewed to listening as it is listening right now in this pandemic to the big corporations and Wall Street and the wealthy and not listening to what average people need. Now, I did not anticipate, obviously, a pandemic, but I did anticipate that we at some point would be in a situation where all of this underlying pattern of power would reveal itself. And I wanted to write something that would be a guidebook to people to understand the contours of power and also how we begin to mobilize to get power back so that the economy and our politics in the future can really reflect the wishes, the goals, the needs of average people and the poor and the working class instead of just the people at the very top. So it's a very ambitious undertaking, but I felt it was really important to do it and get it out as fast as I could. Well, it took me years to write. I focused on a person who, it seemed to me, was the epitome of the system, of the oligarchy. And his name is Jamie Dimon.
Yeah, let me cut in for just a second about that. It's striking that, you know, when I was reading it, to see how you sort of use his portrayal. But let me just say a couple of things. You write, Jamie Dimon says he's a patriot before he's the CEO of JP Morgan. I believe he's sincere, but he is awash in self-delusion, a condition especially dangerous in people who have significant power over others. He doesn't understand how he has hijacked the system. So yeah, both why you chose to use him as a thread and what he reveals.
Jamie Dimon, because he calls himself a Democrat, because he likes to think of himself and he sends his shareholders of JP Morgan Chase every year a letter in which he talks in very progressive terms about what JP Morgan is doing for poor people and for poor cities. He likes to bathe himself in the kind of golden glow of being a reformer and somebody who is liberal. But in fact, Jamie Dimon has, if you look closely at what he does and what his bank is doing, Jamie Dimon represents the worst of the oligarchy. I mean, Jamie Dimon's bank is responsible for redlining, and they continue to do a lot of things that are making the country worse. Jamie Dimon's bank is the biggest lender and supporter and financier of fossil fuels and fracking. Jamie Dimon's bank is repeatedly finding itself in legal hot water for violating all sorts of rules and laws. Jamie Dimon's bank barely pays its frontline workers enough to live on. We're talking about bank tellers. So Jamie Dimon, who talks a good game, and every time CNBC needs a leading Wall Street personage to talk about the economy, he is interviewed. Every time 60 Minutes wants somebody who has a great deal of experience to talk about our society, Jamie Dimon is interviewed. But Jamie Dimon really does reflect the attitudes, the needs, the worldview of a very small number of extraordinarily powerful and wealthy people. Jamie Dimon needs to be exposed, not because he's a bad person. This is not class warfare declared on Jamie Dimon. Jamie Dimon needs to be exposed because he is not a patriot first. He is first the CEO of the biggest bank on Wall Street. Jamie Dimon is also the head of the Business Roundtable, which is a major lobbying group in Washington comprised of the CEOs of the biggest companies in the United States. Again, trying to style themselves as socially responsible when in fact what they really are is profit-seeking entities that put their shareholders first, not America first. Their shareholders first.
Yeah, let me just say a couple of things. One, when I read those quotes from his letters to his shareholders, it was like those, the progressive quotes, you could have written them. You know, he points out that, you know, the how we're failing the middle class and the working class, and then heads the Business Roundtable, which lobbies aggressively against raising the minimum wage, which remains to this day $7.25 an hour.
And lobbies the Trump administration for a gigantic tax cut. that they got in December 2017 that bestowed huge, huge bucks, mega bucks on the big banks, especially JP Morgan Chase, but also on the Fortune 500, the biggest corporations in America. They got, and the wealthy, got something in the order of $2 trillion out of that tax cut. And what did they do with it? Well, most big corporations turned around and just simply repurchased their shares of stock, which was a way of keeping share prices up for the major stockholders and for the CEOs and the top executives. You see, they talk a good game, but actually, when you look closely at what they do, they are acting as we would expect capitalists to act. But you see, here's the problem. They now have huge power. They actually, in many respects, run the United States government. I picked Jamie Dimon in part because he's one of the chief backers of the Democratic Party. He's a chief fundraiser of the Democratic Party. Lloyd Blankfein, who I mentioned earlier, who is now urging that Americans get back to work, you know, put the economy and make the economy a higher priority than the coronavirus. Lloyd Blankfein, chairman, senior chairman of Goldman Sachs, also calls himself a Democrat, also a major backer of the Democratic Party. It doesn't matter which party you are in. You know, the oligopoly, the oligarchy is an oligopoly, but the oligarchy is dominating American politics and American government and making our politicians, forcing and prodding our politicians to make decisions that help them, but do not help average people or the poor or the working class. That's the problem. It would be one thing if they were just making money. That's what we would expect them to do. But pretending that they are putting America first, pretending that they are actually acting on behalf of the United States when they exercise their power in Washington and in state capitals, that's the abuse of power. That's what really underlies the problems that we are facing now at so many levels.
Yeah, you point out, I think one of the key connections in the system is the equation of wealth with power. And you say power is the ability to direct or influence the behavior of others on a large scale. Power is the capacity to set the public agenda. And as I told you, I recently interviewed Branko Milanovic, and one of the things he said, which I know you say as well, is that he points out the vicious cycle. Wealth buys power, which is used to enact policies that ensure greater accumulation of wealth, and thus even greater accumulation of political power. And it is that vicious circle, and it's that equation of wealth with power that is kind of at the root of a lot of what we're talking about.
Exactly. When I was Secretary of Labor, one of my great frustrations was that labor unions were a pale reflection of what they had been in the 50s and 60s in terms of labor union membership and labor union power. What happened? Well, beginning in the late 90s, late 1970s, but actually beginning with Ronald Reagan, the corporations declared war on labor unions. They sought to bust unions, and they took away the most important source of countervailing power in our entire system. I mean, the working class is basically decimated. Even the Democratic Party has lost the working class, not just the white working class. The Democratic Party lost the working class. I was there in the Clinton administration when, sadly, and I'm proud of many things that we accomplished, but very sadly, Bill Clinton turned his back on the American working class, didn't want to move forward with labor law reforms that would have made it easier to form unions, that would have actually put up some sort of barrier between labor unions and workers trying to form unions and what the corporations were doing and trying to bust unions. Would have defended unions much better. The same thing with Barack Obama. Barack Obama, for the first 2 years of his administration, had both houses of Congress, Democrats. Democrats ran the House and the Senate. Barack Obama could have reformed labor laws. That's what labor unions expected him to do. There was a bill before Congress, but Barack Obama, just like Bill Clinton, didn't want to spend the political capital needed to get that law through. So we lost the opportunity to create or enhance countervailing power, to save countervailing power in America. And hence we got into this vicious cycle of wealth, creating more power, creating more wealth, creating more power. There is not a free market. Anybody who understands what is going on and understands our system, and I make this point as strongly as I can in the book, must understand that the free market is a construct. The free market rules come from the people who have the most influence over making those rules. The rules of bankruptcy, the rules of contract law, the rules of intellectual property, the rules with regard to how the capital markets are organized, rules that actually organize the entire free market, those rules come from someplace. The way they are created, and I saw this, and I make a major point about this in the book, and I've seen it for 50 years, in and out of government. Every time I've been in government, I've seen regulations, rules, laws that shape the market, that change the market, that alter the free market. Why are they doing that? They are altering the market in favor of those with the most power over politicians, over regulators, over the system of government. Those with the most power have the most wealth. Those rule changes, changes in laws, regulations, rules, even at the court level, are coming about in large part because of concentrated wealth at the top that is generating more and more power over how the market is organized. That's where you get the vicious cycle.
Absolutely. Okay, we've got like a minute. Two quick things I want to say is I remember when I interviewed you on Super Capitalism, when we talked about the golden age of the middle class, and it was based on countervailing power, that actually the system will ultimately work better even for those wealthy folks and their corporations when we have unions and the whole country is moving forward. And then the research of Gillens and Page, which you cite, which actually shows in concrete evidence that what the people want, if it doesn't agree with what Wall Street wants, never gets enacted. The only time what the people want gets enacted into legislation is when it agrees with what big business wants. Finally, where can listeners learn more and what can we do?
Well, you can learn more if you're so inclined by buying my book. It's called The System, Who Rigged It, How We Fix It. And it is available where all books are sold. And if you've got to order online, Barnes & Noble is still a good place to get books. And so please try there. But more importantly, and more basically, Terrence, I think that we've got to look forward at the next election and elections subsequently. We've got to remember how important it was in 2018 to mobilize and organize. We did that very well in 2018. We got the House back. But who is we? We is not just Democrats. And this is an important point that I hope people take home with them. We are the people. Not the oligarchy, not those with the wealth and power to own government and maximize share the value of shares and maximize the growth of the economy for those at the top. We the people have got to take our government and our economy back. And I hope that what is revealed in this coronavirus epidemic is the structure and the contours of power, so we can do that.
As I said at the start, this is a crisis, can be used, they're kind of inflection points, and the country can go in one direction or the other. And by God, I hope that the people have some power this time around, and they will, because there is an election coming up. So again, the book is The System. The website is robertreich.org, and that's Reich, R-E-I-C-H, Robert Reich, one word, .org. For this conversation and many others, as well as articles and interview transcripts and so on, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website if you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus 8 to 10 articles to flesh out the conversation. You can sign up at my site, or you can email me at T.E. McNally at Mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most major podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at those others. Anytime, anywhere, you can listen to Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G. Lee and Mark Maxwell. And in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Robert Reich. Keep up the good work.